On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I don't know. I don't think there is a middle class anymore. You're either low income or you're rich now. That's what I think.
I would consider myself sort of on the lower end of middle class.
Middle class is pretty much the person that's probably making less than $100,000 a year. And people that are still trying to wake up every day, go to work, and survive and feed their family.
Middle class is not just about the amount of money your parents can make or you make, but it's also the actual class, your level of education, where you grew up. There's so many little aspects to it that defines your class.
Used to consider middle class, maybe you didn't have a lot extra, but you were able to make your bills comfortably and put a small amount into savings, you know, every paycheck. But it seems now to be more living paycheck to paycheck.
Angelino's talking about how they define middle class today. Well, according to a new report from the Pew Research Center, America has reached a tipping point when it comes to the middle class. For the first time in decades, slightly less than half the population is now middle class. That's because more Americans have moved into the upper or lower income brackets, leaving fewer people in the middle. And here to tell us more about the report is Rakesh Kochhar. He is the Associate Director of Research at Pew and the lead author of the report. It's called The American Middle Class is Losing Ground. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Madeline.
Well, how do you define middle class in your report? How much money does a family of four, let's say, have to make?
So in our report, the middle class definition is based on income alone, and it depends on your household size also. So if a family of three earning from $42,000 to about $126,000 was middle income in our study. And if you earned more than $126,000, you were upper income. If you earned less than $42,000, you were lower income.
Okay, and how has that changed since 1971?
So starting in 1971, we see that 61% of the U.S. adult population lived in middle-income households. Now, this starts to diminish steadily decade after decade, and at this moment, 50% of American adults are in middle-income households. If you look at the numbers alone, they are slightly outnumbered by people in lower and upper income households at this time.
Well, let's talk about the upper income bracket, because one of the most surprising findings of your study is that that bracket has grown faster than the lower income bracket. So does that mean more people have moved from the middle income to the upper income? Do we have more rich people now than we used to, or do we just have fewer people who got a lot richer, or both?
It's both. As the middle has shrunk in size, people are going somewhere. And we find that overall the American population is moving both up and down, but there is more movement up the ladder. So the share of people in upper income households has gone up from 14 to 21% today. And the share of people in lower income households has gone up from 25% in 1970 to 29% today. So on balance, there's actually more movement up than down.
So is that good news then?
It depends on your perspective, I imagine. And it still is the case that there are more lower income households, 29%, than upper income households, 21%. So the weight overall still tilts to the lower end.
Mm-hmm. All right. Talk a little bit about the demographics of your study. Who's doing well and who is not doing well?
So demographically, some people progressed more up the economic ladder than others. And in terms of gains, we find that older adults, that's people 65 and older, and married couples and African Americans did better than other adults. So for older adults, we find this is because of improvements in Social Security and Medicare benefits, and that more of them are at work in the so-called retirement years at this time than in the past. Among married couples, more and more both work, which adds to household resources, of course. And there's also a correlation between education and marriage. More educated people are more likely to be married. And among Blacks, we have seen improvements in educational attainment over time. Now, we do need to put this in some perspective. Older adults, and Blacks especially, remain more likely to be lower income than other people overall. So there is more catching up to do.
Okay, and who's doing poorly?
Most notably, people without a bachelor's degree have slipped down the income ladder. And compared to those people who are high-skilled with a college degree, it is not a good time to be without one.
And what about young people? How are they doing, millennials?
Not so well, not as well as older adults. And a lot of this probably has to do with the fact that they're coming of age, coming into the labor market following the Great Recession.
And that they might have large college bills to pay.
Well, in our case, we are not subtracting away that debt. We're just looking at their gross income. So, but yes, if you have large bills in the form of debt, that would make you feel like you're struggling more.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's Rakesh Kochhar, Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center. And now I'd like to bring in Chris Thornburg, founding partner of Beacon Economics here in LA. Hi, Chris.
Hey.
And also Jacob Hacker, professor of political science at Yale. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Chris, let's start with you. How does a report like this translate into the Los Angeles area? I imagine you have to make more money to be middle class here in Los Angeles because it's so expensive.
Oh, absolutely, given the higher cost of living, particularly when it comes to housing, as the case may be. Indeed, like so many of the national trends we see on everything from diversity and race to diversity and income, L.A. is way ahead of the game. We, as a metropolis, have a far higher share of the highly skilled folks and a far higher share of the low-skilled folks. As noted by the last researcher, that means that our income distribution is much wider, and the middle class, at least as they are defining it, is quite a bit smaller.
Right. And what about people's net income and how much they're able to save and, you know, maybe put down?
Right. And I think that's an important part of this research that needs to be acknowledged. As there was sort of one of the last things that was said was that this is based on gross income numbers.
Uh-huh.
And there's a big difference in the United States between gross and net income, obviously. In fact, I think in the lead up to the program, there was even some conversation about, you know, are Americans for income redistribution. Well, we already have at some level quite a bit of income redistribution. On the high end, of course, because of progressive tax systems, folks are paying a lot more in taxes. At the low end, everything from Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, disability, housing subsidies, welfare, I can go on and on with mm-hmm. a variety of programs out there to help low-income families and give them a better lifestyle. It isn't to say that it's too much or not enough. I think that's a different debate for a different day. But it does need to be noted that these numbers don't necessarily completely correlate, if you will, with lifestyle, as the case may be.
Okay. Jacob Hacker at Yale, let's bring you in. What is your first reaction to this Pew report and these numbers?
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say is it is not surprising, given the trends that we've seen over the last generation. I mean, when we talk about inequality, it often takes on a very abstract air, but the reality is that what's happened is a real polarization where the middle has, fallen out of the American economy. And the numbers are pretty stunning in the report. I think one of the things that that we haven't talked about is the sort of share of aggregate income. You know, they define the top as, it ranges from family size, but, you know, it's around 70 for a single to, you know, 150,000 for a larger family. And they note that above that level, about half of all income in the economy is accruing. And if you look beneath the numbers, it's really at the very top where we've seen most of the income go. And so we've seen a real shift in our economy since the 1970s, where most of the gains of economic growth over the last 25 years or so have been going to the top of the income distribution. And, you know, Chris is right that there's been efforts to offset that with the tax code, but they haven't kept up by any means with this transformation. And so I think the first thing to just say is that what we're seeing is a real transformation of American society and its structure, and one that is causing clearly a lot of unease in the country.
Now, this is something that we have been talking about increasingly just in the last few years, especially since the Great Recession. But this report shows that this has been happening since 1971.
That's exactly right. And it's not just a result of the downturn, although the downturn really devastated especially the wealth holdings of the middle class, and it brought family incomes back to levels that had existed at the tail end of the Reagan administration. So it's a really big regression. But yes, this is a long-term trend.
Okay, so I guess let's talk about policy, proposals and ways to address this issue. And if this is indeed something that is on the front burner of, in the minds of politicians and in the minds of voters, what can be done? I mean, Chris mentioned there's a whole bunch of different ways that we already do some income redistribution. What more can be done? And what would the American public stomach at this point?
Well, those are obviously two different questions. And the first thing to say is that Americans are deeply concerned about this, but they have a great deal of skepticism about the ability of political leaders and government to deal with it. And I think the attraction to candidates that are blaming immigrants or who are suggesting that this is really a result of overreach of government are trying to respond to this angst in a way that doesn't suggest that we need to have more government efforts to address the problem. And so that skepticism is a big part of the politics. But you know, there's a lot of evidence that we could, we could do a set of things that would help. And that, in fact, although all countries have seen growing inequality, the United States has experienced it much more acutely than other rich countries. So, this ranges from labor market reforms like raising the minimum wage and encouraging unionization, particularly among workers in the service sector and at the low end of the labor market, to changing the tax code in ways that that make it more progressive, particularly at the very top. The sort of richest of the rich are often able to pay less in taxes than the merely rich. And they include lots of measures that would be designed to addressing this over the long term, like investing in stronger education for the less advantaged and ensuring better chances of upward mobility. So there aren't a shortage of options. They're not inexpensive, some of these options. And I think the real problem is political, that these changes have unleashed a lot of skepticism about government. And, frankly, the winners in this process are a lot more politically influential than the losers.
And Chris Thornburg, you study housing a lot at Beacon Economics. And so where does this fit into this conversation?
Yeah.
Because that is, for many Americans, their biggest source of wealth.
Right. And of course, I want to back up. I'm going to address that question, but I want to do so by just picking up a little bit on what the other speaker was saying. Remember that if you have changes in tax policies, that's not going to influence this report at all, because this report is about gross income, not net income, and there's a very important distinction there. Again, that's not saying we have enough or too much, as the case may be. Just keep that in mind.
Right.
The ways to address growing income inequality really boils down to education and making sure that as many kids as possible are getting through high school, that are getting into college and moving forward, and also addressing the chronic issues of a lack of skills, particularly among new immigrants, particularly from Latin America, Central America, areas like that, folks who come here without having had the opportunity of getting a good education and thus really populate that low end. Those would help directly dealing with the gross stuff. Now, coming back to housing, housing is a funny thing, because housing is both, of course, a function of wealth as well as a function of a cost, as the case may be for people, say, trying to live in L.A., as the case may be. The high cost of housing here obviously puts a big squeeze, particularly on people in the middle class. But that's true in most dense urban areas. People make that decision, and what they do is they say, well, listen, I'm going to have a lot less in the way of housing, and I'm going to live my life in other ways. I'm going to enjoy myself in other ways. But we could, particularly at the low end of the distribution, alleviate some of the pressures on folks by dealing with the chronic housing shortage that we have in the overall area.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Run out of time. Thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.
That was Chris Thornburg, founding partner of Beacon Economics here in L.A., and Jacob Hacker, professor of political science at Yale and the author of the book Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you feel middle class? Maybe you make enough money to be in the upper income group and you still feel economically insecure. Let us know your thoughts at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the hot toy this holiday season may be spying on you. We'll talk Hello Barbie and other tech stuff with Jenny Jardin. That's next on Press Play.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Jenny Jardin is here, as she is most Thursdays, to talk tech and web culture. She is the co-editor of boingboing.net. Hi, Jenny.
Hey, Madeline.
Okay, well, it is that time of the year again, where we're eagerly looking forward to toys that can spy on us under the Christmas
tree. It's the most spyingest time of the year.
That's nice. Okay, we're talking about Hello Barbie.
Yes.
She talks to you and you talk back, and here's how Mattel promotes it. Just like a real friend, Hello Barbie, TM, doll listens and remembers the user's likes and dislikes, giving everyone their own unique experience. What do you think of that? Critics are saying that this is a perfect storm of a terrible toy that threatens children's privacy, well-being, and creativity.
Hey, wow. Okay, well, that will definitely get people to click on headlines. What we at Boing Boing were writing about this toy and other smart toys, which listen to what your child says and record or transmit that to a third-party server, you know, owned by Mattel or whoever the toy maker is. It's perhaps there's a way to do this right. It doesn't really look like anybody's doing this right in terms of security and privacy at this time. Recently, there was a massive breach of a big, I think it was a Hong Kong-based company called VTech.
Yeah.
Massive, popular toy maker. Hackers accessed millions of records. So I think the number was at first like 2.8 million, and then it doubled. We're talking about customer records of families with children who own the toys. With the Hello Barbie and with other smart dolls that listen sort of like Siri on your mm-hmm. iPhone. They listen to what your child is saying, and then they formulate a response, maybe pick one of a number of canned scripts, or maybe like Siri, there's some AI, artificial intelligence involved. You know, that sounds like an interesting concept if you're a toy designer, but
It also sounds a little bit creepy. Let's be honest.
If you're a mom or a dad or anybody who cares about the safety of a child, like if you've got their voice, their location, that's a lot of data to trust a toy maker. You know, we're not talking about the Department of Defense here, people, to transmit that to a server. You have no idea if any of this stuff is encrypted, hashed. We have no idea what the security is.
Probably most people don't even think about that. They don't even think that this is an issue.
Yeah. And because of that, I am recommending that everybody buy lumps of coal or hand whittled, you know, on Etsy. You can get some lovely hand whittled stump dolls.
Right. How about just a doll that doesn't talk to you in that way, or just has the chip in it, you know, when you pull the little string and it talks back?
Hey, they were good enough for me.
Exactly.
You can see how I turned out. Child of the 70s.
So are there a lot of these toys that have this technology?
It's becoming very popular. It's a way to extract more money from parents.
Oh, okay. Great.
Smart doll. More like Goodbye Barbie. Okay. I just pwned them.
Okay. Let's talk about Bitcoin. We haven't heard about Bitcoin or from Bitcoin in a while, but now it seems that someone has found the inventor, the enigmatic Satoshi Nakamoto.
You know, I got to hand it to the guys at Gawker. I think Sam Biddle was one of the reporters on this story. This is a really interesting piece that they put out today. Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency,
you know, the Silk Road, the big underground drug markets online,
they
couldn't happen without Bitcoin. So there's a lot of dark uses of this cryptocurrency, but it's also a completely sensible kind of platform for the future of money. And the pseudonymous, we presume, Satoshi Nakamoto, who is credited with being the mastermind of Bitcoin, there have been many attempts to unmask him. The most famous of these, in how catastrophically wrong it went, was Newsweek. And they, I think it was their cover story, and the whole thing was debunked, and it was just like some poor guy who, that was his birth name, he's an engineer.
Yeah, and, now he... and reporters were camped out in front of his house, and yeah.
So it shows you the kind of demand there is to uncloak something that, that exists in a world of secrecy. Gawker sure looks to me like they've tracked down at least somebody who's very close to the center of Bitcoin, if not the one person. Who knows? Maybe Satoshi Nakamoto is a pseudonym for all of the guys who created it together.
And
maybe.
Who is this person okay, that they so, found?
They found one guy who was an Australian citizen and another who was a man, sounded like he had drug and alcohol problems. He suffered a motorcycle accident, was confined to a wheelchair, was discovered in Florida, like dead on the ground. They included a lot of yucky details about poop and blood and stuff and human suffering. They staked out the Australian guy's house. They talked to a woman there, I suppose his wife. They describe her, you know, coyly smiling and shutting the door when asked, is your husband the mastermind of Bitcoin?
Why do they think he is the founder?
Somebody approached Gawker with a stash of emails between these guys and Australian government and finance ministers, banking officials. You know, it's actually interesting. They did kind of what our security services, what the NSA might do with captured communications, captured emails, captured text messages or phone calls. They sort of looked at the social network around the suspect, the suspected Satoshi Nakamoto, and pieced together ways to validate the fact that they thought he was the guy with the communication of people around him. So I don't know.
All right. Finally, Southern California, home to Silicon Beach, lots of high-tech entertainment companies, and yet...
our internet stinks.
Really slow internet. So now there's a plan. Google and AT&T are both working to give us really fast internet. Is that going to happen?
It sounds like it is. There's a number of municipal plans for public internet that are also in the works. But Los Angeles is apparently partnering with Google Fiber to bring this much faster capacity infrastructure to LA. I mean, I'm on Time Warner, and the absolute best service that Time Warner offers is probably 100 times worse than what this promises to bring. And I'm in one of those neighborhoods, too, where we, every time I see Fios offered, it's like I hear the angels crying. And I call Verizon right away, and they say, oh, sorry, it's actually not available in your neighborhood. And I think that, you know, Google has had great success in other cities, smaller cities throughout the Midwest where much of this started. They're creating infrastructure with the future in mind. We're not going to get that from cable companies or telecoms. So I for one, am stoked.
Great. When can we take advantage of this? Is there a date?
There isn't a date yet. It looks like we're talking about 2016. And then also...
so soon.
Yeah. But like the devil's in the details with these with these things. I know that with the new train lines that everybody's so excited about, there's talk of having public Wi-Fi in different routes along public transportation. So if you're at LAX, they've finally upgraded their Wi-Fi as well. But I think if this happens, we're also going to see a lot of conflict with the carriers that they're going to be displacing. So I'd be interested to see what Verizon or Time Warner Cable has to say about this stuff.
It would be really nice to just have free Wi-Fi everywhere in L.A. and in, you know, everywhere.
I think it really makes sense for the city to invest in that.
Yeah.
I think it really does, because more communication, the ease of communication sets up entire new marketplaces. Like, we're Hollywood. It should be really easy for us to communicate through video wherever we are.
Yeah.
That's the future of advertising, too. So There's money to be made in them NAR tubes.
Okay. Let's get there, Satoshi. Shani Jardin.
That's not me.
Really? Are you sure?
Promise.
Shani Jardin, co-editor of boingboing.net. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Hey, have you ever found your kids talking to their toys and wondered, were the toys listening? Leave us a message at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. We may play it later in the show. Coming up, how in just a short amount of time, the United States went from dubious to enthusiastic about unmanned aircraft.
The worry is that drones enable countries like the United States to carry out this war without actually having to say we're at war with those countries.
The ethics of drone warfare after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Drones are now very much a part of how we think about warfare. Need proof? There's a Hollywood thriller on the way that tackles the ethical implications of drones.
Matt, what's happening?
Yo, we're seeing a
suicide vest and a bunch of
explosives.
We need to put a hellfire through that roof right now.
We need a decision, Minister, right now.
You have two men about to embark on a suicide mission.
We need clearance from the PM.
Weapon is arms.
What's that? Zoom in.
Fire fairy!
Jesus.
High in the Sky comes out in March, and what you heard there was a drone operator spotting a little girl right after his boss tells him to fire missiles directly at that location. Civilian casualties, waging war without ever sending an army into a country. There are many moral and ethical questions when it comes to drone warfare. We heard yesterday about the international rules, or lack thereof, when it comes to drones. Today, how the U.S. went from being dubious about armed drones to mounting hundreds of drone attacks every year. When I talked to Cornell University drone expert Sarah Kreps earlier, I started by asking her when the United States first started using drone warfare.
The U.S. used drones in the 90s war in Bosnia, and so they were flying around Predators. They were made by General Atomics, and this was sort of the first, what I would say, the first modern use of drones, because there are some earlier use of drones for intelligence or surveillance in Vietnam and by the Israelis in the 80s. But what we think of as the modern type of drone, this medium altitude, long endurance drone like the Predator or the Reaper, was in the 1990s in Bosnia. But these were unarmed. There was this debate about whether we should arm the drones, and that was taking place in around 2000. Really, that debate fell off the table on 9/11, and when the U.S. took sort of the gloves off, and it was clear that this was something that the U.S. had to do. And so it was using drones then, armed drones, in Afghanistan starting October 2001. And so that was a second major inflection point. But then I think the third one that I would point to as a major development was in 2002. And the reason why this was in November 2002 in Yemen, when the U.S. conducted its first strike outside a declared battlefield in Yemen, when they used an armed Predator to target the perpetrator of the 2000 USS Cole attack.
Okay, so take us back to 9/11 and how the thinking changed from sending unarmed drones out to actually arming drones.
Again, you have the debate in 2000, and there's this question, well, that seems like kind of drastic action to now suddenly arm these platforms that are unmanned. And we know that a number of things changed after 9/11. And this is when we get the enhanced interrogation, we get the detention, we get Guantanamo, and we get armed Predators. So we arm Predators with Hellfire missiles. And I think it was, again, in this context of we need to throw everything at this problem of terrorism. But the allure of being able to strike from afar without incurring any casualties. And think about what was happening in Afghanistan at the time. So this is Rumsfeld, and he's wanting to conduct these, what he called this light footprint. So he said that we don't want to look at what the Soviets did in Afghanistan in the 80s. They sent in divisions and divisions of infantry. Clearly that didn't work. And so Predators fit right in with that idea that you could have this light footprint, not even have them based in Afghanistan, send them in, conduct their strikes, and come back out and not have any casualties.
And then tell us about Yemen in 2002 and what was unique about the strike that happened then.
When we think about the current debate about drone strikes, there's very little controversy about using drones for strikes in what are known as active battlefields, or such as Afghanistan or Iraq. And what was different about 2002 was that we were not involved in an armed conflict in Yemen. The U.S. had no troops in Yemen. And suddenly we see this target in Yemen, and the United States uses an armed predator to take out this suspected terrorist. And I think what this has given rise to is this concern about expanding the battlefield in time and space. So the U.S. has not declared any sort of, in any way, conflict or that Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia are battle spaces. And yet it has now periodically conducted drone strikes there. And again, the worry is that this is, that drones enable countries like the United States to carry out this war without actually having to say we're at war with those countries. So it can limit the domestic backlash, again, because there are no body bags coming back from these places. It can take out these suspected terrorists in a way that sort of seems antiseptic.
Okay, so let's assess the program since then. How has the drone program changed? How has it evolved since then? Can you give us some statistics? How many strikes have there been? How many civilian casualties? How many successful targets?
So between 2001 and 2008, there were about 50 of these strikes. And by that, I mean the ones that are outside places like Afghanistan and Iraq. And I emphasize that because those are the ones that are, again, most controversial. Since 2008, so between in the Obama administration, it has been more than 450. And there are just fewer than 4,000 casualties. And of that, about 10% have been thought to be civilian casualties. We don't always know. So gauging what the percentage of civilian casualties has been very tricky. In general, it appears, and this is something that the UN has actually acknowledged, that the targeting practices have appeared to get more accurate, that we appear to be taking out the targets we're intending to take out, and that the so-called collateral damage problem has gotten somewhat better. So when we hear that percentage or number of civilian casualties, I think it's fair to say that that has gone down. Now, President Obama has said that it has gone down to zero. He said last year that it had been zero. A lot of groups dispute that. And I think the reason why you get disputes about it is that you have different views about who a civilian versus a combatant is. Now, there have been other groups like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch that have gone in and sent, and this is an Amnesty report, they sent in a field team to Yemen to actually interview people on the ground to really get a handle on whether those people who were targeted were civilians or combatants. And they found that these rates were much higher than what the government had reported. But I think a lot of this has to do with discrepancies in who's a civilian and who's a combatant. And so you might imagine that people, you go and do interviews and you interview the person's brother, and the brother says, well, no, actually, obviously my brother is innocent. He was a civilian. And so you can, it can be quite debatable because of that quite fine line between civilian and combatant.
So previous policy has emphasized capturing terrorists to get the intelligence from them rather than killing them. Mm-hmm. And obviously, drones don't do that. They're about maybe long-distance surveillance and intelligence gathering and killing suspected terrorists. So does that mean that we have deprioritized capturing, you know, would-be terrorists and getting intelligence that way in this war on terror?
For sure. It's interesting to note that the Obama administration has said that it has a preference for capture versus killing suspected terrorists. But in 90% of cases where we've gone after suspected terrorists, we've killed them rather than captured them. And, you know, there are obvious reasons for why. These are terrorists for a reason. They're armed and dangerous. And so when the U.S. has sent in special forces to try to There's an interesting case, actually, of in Somalia in 2013. So it went after a suspected terrorist early in October of 2013. It encountered enemy fire. The U.S. withdrew. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, they went in with armed drones and took the person out. And what I think it suggests is, or illustrates, is sort of the perceived virtues of armed drones, which is, you know, you go in with special forces, you try to capture the guy, you encounter enemy fire, you withdraw because this is not going to be very good PR for really anyone. Somalia is not going to be good PR for the U.S. government, the U.S. Special Forces. And it's, again, much more seemingly antiseptic to just send in the armed drone and kill the person. Now, as you suggest, what we're doing is foregoing the potential intelligence value. But the other thing to highlight is this concern about where do you put them? What we know is that the Obama administration has been trying to close Guantanamo. So what do you do with these suspected terrorists if you capture them? And these are like political hot potatoes. No member of Congress wants to say that this suspected terrorist is now being tried in their district. And, you know, there are cases where this has been done very well, but there's a PR problem, is just that the optics of this don't look good. This is especially now, I think, this is when you know, you can look around the country and see just sort of these visceral responses by mayors and governors that really are not rational based on probabilities and events on the ground, but this is all politics.
But isn't there then the boomerang effect, if you will, of these drone strikes creating an angry populace on the ground and potentially creating more terrorists in the long run?
Yeah, no, I think this is an extremely valid point. Now, what's interesting is that this highlights the difference between what people refer to as the tactical consequences versus the strategic consequences. And the tactical is, are you getting these bad guys and taking them out? And even people who are critical of drone strikes will say that tactically, these are quite effective. You know, you're taking suspected terrorists off the playing field. But where there's more debate is about the strategic or longer term consequences of this. And theoretically, I think it makes sense. What people refer to this as the martyrdom effect, which I think is what you're getting at. Mm-hmm. So you kill this one individual. Now these groups, which is now seems to be ISIS, can use these targeted killings to recruit new terrorists. So there are a lot of different reasons why you might see increases in the number of terrorists. And drone strikes might be one of them. And, you know, I would say that qualitatively, there's evidence to suggest that this has been a recruiting device. You know, even the Nobel Prize winner, one of the co-winners from 2014, who's from Pakistan, had said, you know, she said when she met with President Obama, she said, please just end these drone strikes. This is making the problem worse. You know, give us textbooks instead of drone strikes. And what this gets at, I think, is this question that you're asking, which is how do we deal with terrorism as a bigger problem? So the problem with drone strikes is that they don't deal with the root cause of terrorism. And so this reference to textbooks is one where a more holistic perspective on the question of terrorism and recruitment. Let's educate the population. Let's give them employment, give them some alternative to one of antipathy toward this outsider like the United States. And I think there's a solid argument and a very sort of logically sound one to suggest that the terrorist strikes over the long term are not only not dealing with the root cause, but actually inflaming these local populations and making the problem worse.
Now, you were former Air Force yourself. Has your thinking changed on this?
I was in the Air Force between active duty between 1999 and 2003. And so I write in my forthcoming book about this experience in 2001 about this snowflake that had come down from Rumsfeld. How can we arm the predators with Hellfire missiles and do it quickly? And so, you know, I saw this missive, and at the time I was part of the community that was responsible for dealing with that, basically an engineering problem. It was about a decade later that I was looking at this issue as an academic, and I could see this even early on, is that this became a hammer, having a hammer where everything looked like a nail. And I think this is something that even President Obama has talked about, that this had come to be seen as a cure-all for terrorism. But I think taking a step back now, again, having had that experience and now taking a step back, I think I'm sympathetic to these concerns about how the technology can seem like this elixir for a problem that is one that can't really be solved with technology.
Sarah Krepps, Associate Professor of Government at Cornell University. And Warren Olney is here now to preview To the Point at 1 o'clock. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Good. Glad to hear it. I am fine, too. We're going to have a very interesting conversation, I think, about ISIS and how ISIS is financed, not just by oil and looted antiquities and bank vaults, but also by taxing and fining and, in other ways, oppressing the very people that they are ruling. And it's not just a matter of providing services, which they do too. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they charge for those. But they have what appears to be a very complex, very cleverly organized bureaucracy. And I think it descends from the Ba'ath Party in Iraq and, of course, in Syria as well. And so it's very well organized. But the question becomes, when you enforce it with beheadings and beatings and that sort of thing, how long are people going to stand for that? One of our guests will compare it, I think, to the mafia.
Oh, okay. Great. Yeah. All right. Well, look forward to that at 1 o'clock. Yeah. To the Point. And Warren Olney, thank you.
Okay.
And coming up on this program, an economic story, the rise and fall of the K-Cup, how those single-serve coffee pods became surprisingly popular and why the company made a big mistake trying to capitalize on that. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You're probably familiar with K-Cups, those plastic containers that deliver caffeine in whatever flavor you want. Well, those little pods made by Keurig Green Mountain Coffee are a brand beloved by consumers until, that is, those consumers turned on the company. Because aren't all those K-Cups kind of bad for the environment? And the coffee, is it any good? Well, private equity came to the rescue. A European firm bought the Green Mountain Coffee Company this week for nearly $14 billion. Joining me now to discuss the rise and fall and perhaps rise again of Keurig is Daniel Klein, contributor to Motley Fool. Motley Fool, hi. I don't want to give
hi,
you a
how
flu.
Are you?
You're perfectly
I'm
healthy.
Not sure I would say fall. Maybe stumble is probably a better
stumble.
Word.
A stumble. Okay,
happened.
Yeah, because $14 billion is not chump change. So there
well,
must
K-Cups
be some value
still
there.
They're still very popular, but as a public company, the fact that sales have started to slip is very bad. But believe me, most private companies would take the kind of business Keurig has been doing up until this sale.
Yeah. Okay, so one in three American homes has a single brew coffee machine, which kind of blows my mind. How did that happen?
Well, it happened sort of overnight. So Green Mountain was a local coffee roaster that sort of slowly built up a national business, went public. They were selling to offices, convenience stores, basically every sort of offbeat place had Green Mountain coffee. And then in 2006, they bought Keurig, which was this little tiny company making this single brewer, the K-Cup brewer. And at that point, it sort of exploded. For a while, it was a wedding registry item, something you bought as a gift, kind of an aspirational $200-$300 thing. And then in 2008, 2009, when they brought the price point down to under $100, it became something everyone had at home, which then spread to, well, we better get this at the office too. So it really became ubiquitous.
Yeah, and then the company comes out with this Keurig 2 machine and the Keurig Cold with 2 Ks, well, Keurig Cold.
Well, let's look at those separately. So the Keurig 2.0 was sort of the crack in the armor. What happened with that is the Keurig 2.0 has digital rights management. It means that you could only use licensed K-Cups. And the vast majority of K-Cups are licensed, but local grocery chains, a couple of off-brands, would make ones without a license, and they worked in the old machines, and in the new machines, they didn't work. So even though that didn't affect that many people, the company's fans got a little angry with it, and then an environmental backlash built because you also couldn't use reusable coffee pods in the Keurig 2.0, which now you can because of the backlash. But so basically, it was a really well-liked company that sort of did some things that enraged its fan base.
Well, what was the particular source of that rage? Was it the changing it around, as you just mentioned, or was it the environmental thing, which was worse?
The environmental issue is probably worse, but that also plays into the price. When when Keurig was a novelty, when you first got it, it was, oh my, everyone in the office can have a different flavor. Mom can have one, dad can have another. But then when you start to look at the math, you go, oh my God, I'm spending 50 cents a dollar for a cup of coffee. That's what it cost me to brew a pot. And then pile the environmental damage on top of it. And there was the whole Kill the K-Cup movement, which is a very slick internet piece that showed sort of how much landfill damage it was doing. And Keurig responded well. They've pledged to make all K-Cups recyclable by 2020, but that didn't really sort of, you know, dim the damage.
Okay, so let's jump ahead to this week. And Keurig is sold to a private equity firm, a German private equity firm?
Yeah, it's a company that's basically buying up coffee brands. They own Peet's, they own Caribou Coffee, they own an awful lot of, you know, minor roasters and small chains, and their goal is to take on Nespresso, which is the sort of the Nestle answer to the K-Cup machine that's very, very popular in the rest of the world. Almost all of Keurig sales are here in the U.S., and in the rest of the world where espresso is more popular, it's generally Nespresso machines. So they're amassing all these things that can sort of feed into a chain, and Keurig wasn't a very good public business, but it's a very good private business. It makes a lot of money. It just wasn't growing anymore.
Okay, so what does this say, though, about the way we consume coffee and other assorted hot beverages at home?
Well, we're wasteful. You know, it's silly to be in an office with five or six people and spend, you know, $12 for everybody to have two cups of coffee when you could have spent a dollar for everybody to share a pot. But it speaks to, we all want it exactly our way, exactly our flavor. He wants pumpkin spice, I want peppermint mocha, and you know, that was very, very appealing, but there's a downside. As a business, you look at it and go, oh, my God, our coffee costs have gone through the roof. And, you know, individuals look at the same thing. And, you know, it's a very nice product, but maybe it's a secondary product in the home next to a traditional coffee maker.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, though, because there, I don't know about you, but here in Los Angeles, there's just an explosion of specialty coffee shops that charge an arm and a leg for a cup of coffee, and often it's a cold cup of coffee.
So, yeah, and I think the difference, and I think that's part of what's feeding into the Keurig backlash. Yeah. The reality is that K-Cups make an okay cup of coffee. You know, it's equivalent to 7-Eleven. It's not equivalent to walking into a, you know, a place that's doing a hand press or a cold brew or something really fancy.
Yeah.
So you're spending a decent amount of money, you know, 50 cents to a dollar for a relatively small cup of coffee that's just sort of meh. So, you know, you could see why people might switch back to grinding their own beans and, you know, sort of doing it a different way.
Right. So are people willing to spend a lot on their coffee still?
Absolutely. You know, I think People look and say, well, Keurig had a bit of a slowdown. It did. It had a slowdown, but it didn't fall off a cliff. It dropped by a few percent in K-Cup sales. So there's still an awful lot of people buying these for home and in the office, and there's some niche players. Starbucks has its Verismo machine. Nespresso has some market share in the U.S. You know, you're starting to see higher-end plays. I'm sure you've all seen those. You've seen those ads with Sofia Vergara for the machine that makes lattes and all sorts of things that's, you know, $300-$400. So there's definitely a market for it, but it's not an endlessly growing market.
Daniel Klein, Motley Fool contributor, thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Myers, we happen to have a K-Cup machine right here in our studios.
Not like in this room.
But
that would be funny if you could hear me doing it right now.
Why? Because we don't really have a kitchen.
That's entirely accurate.
So we have to have it.
We don't have a sink in our kitchen, which is actually hybrid kitchen and
paper mache.
I actually had a producer start with us this week, and she asked me where the kitchen was, despite the fact that her desk is right next to the kitchen, because she thought it was just a copy room. And I was like, no, look around the corner. There's a fridge at the end of that tiny room.
The copy room smells like coffee, strangely.
Yes, so we do have one of these K-Cup, these very, very controversial K-Cup machines. And you might not be surprised, but we put the question to our listeners. K-Cups? Yes? No? Resounding.
No.
Deafening. Absolutely not. No. Erica Schwert says, I don't like using them, but the brief time I did get reusable K-Cup pods and just bought my favorite coffee to grind, I still preferred the old school Mr. Coffee or French press. So that's the taste question.
Yeah.
The fact that these things...
They don't taste good. Let's just say I've had my fair share here.
I am a gas station coffee aficionado, and they taste just like my favorite blend from Shell or Chevron. Little bit of
really?
Diesel in it.
Nice.
I don't like the bougie stuff. I can't palate it. Lori John says, these things taste awful. There is no way. She would much rather just make whatever in Mr. Coffee at home. And Sharon Smith Fuderfoss says that they need to actually ban K-Cups. There should be a law against them, along with plastic water bottles and plastic spouts that come on milk cartons. So wasteful. What is a plastic spout on a milk carton? I'm reading that and I don't know what that is.
You know, I mean, you have it on the side. It's like a carton, looks like a juice carton.
Oh, I suppose.
And juice has that as well.
Okay.
So that you can pour it more easily. It's all about convenience.
Hey, we learned a lot today.
There
was
sure
drones,
did.
There was the middle class, and there was the plastic spouts on milk cartons.
Exactly. You're going to go home a very educated woman. Thank you,
and
Jolie
caffeinated.
Myers.
And
caffeinated. Highly caffeinated.
That's right.
If you stop at the gas station, that is. All right. We're going to end it right here and get more educated with Warren Olney at 1 o'clock. So keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon, everyone, caffeine-fueled or not. I'll see you tomorrow.